I'm not ready to write another Sun Eater series. I need to do something else. Magic's cool. In a sense, all books are the same size because they're the size of a plot, right? Art is art, but publishing is business. People complain about Aragorn. They complain about Tolkien's characters in general as being very flat and undynamic. And they aren't. They had all of their growth before the story started. Aragorn is just a grown-up. Really, all of Sun Eater is born out of my contempt for spoiler culture. Right? Nothing makes me angrier than people screaming, bro, spoilers, at a thing.
Welcome back, everybody, to another Tudor Ramble episode. I'm one of your hosts, Austin.
I'm your other host, Richard.
And this is Chris Ferracchio, author of Sun Eater.
And who let you in my house?
Actually, I think your wife.
It was Jenna.
Yeah. It was Jenna. 100%. She was very kind to us. Christopher was a little weirded out, but, yep. You know.
We've already talked about it. We also took the good couch chair as well.
True. Yeah. It's my favorite chair.
Yeah.
See, if you ever have problems trying to get in contact with authors, what you have to do is then, you know, go find the wife. A lot more accommodating.
Yes.
Yeah. She's better about answering email these days than I am. So that's the move for sure.
We said it, and if we did have another video, we said this, but thank you for having us at your house. This has been awesome.
Oh, gosh, no. Thanks for being here.
We've been here for the gala, which we also talked about. You can see that. Otherwise, we're here to talk about Sun Eater as a series. Book 7 was just released. Our review is up if you want to go check that out. We're going to give you spoiler warnings when talking about the series, but first we're going to ask Christopher about the writing process, how it was writing book 7, and then we'll get into all the weeds of stuff.
Yeah.
So, all right, Rich, do you want to take it away?
So, overall, for people who don't know, when did this series start in your head?
It depends on how you count. I have been trying to be a writer since I was probably 8. I think vaguely the reason I decided it was, well, I like books, right? I was reading very early. I remember I was given the first Harry Potter book when it came out. I was 4. And I'd struggled with it, obviously, but my dad read it to me and I really, really liked it. And I remember the other 4-year-olds were like, "You think you're smarter than us?" And it's, you know,
yes.
4-year-old me maybe. Did, you know, I've sobered on that point a little bit, but I probably did say yes, and that's probably why I got bullied, but here we are. But I'm just old enough to remember being bullied for liking Harry Potter, right? But probably around 8, 10, that's when the Lord of the Rings movies were coming out. That's when I got into Lord of the Rings, got the Robert Inglis audiobooks, and that really helped. I listened to those things until the CDs broke. I would fall asleep listening to them over and over and over again. When I listened to the circus recordings that he did in the last couple of years, I was like irritated that he didn't intonate the sentences exactly the same way, because I have such a strong memory of the Inglis performance. Not that I don't love Andy Serkis, he's like the best, but I just so much with those recordings, spent so much time with those recordings. But I think I wanted to be a writer specifically because the lift to being a writer, technically speaking, was easiest. I just needed a book and a pencil or a word processor. I didn't need film school or equipment or anything. And so I just started writing, and I was writing on the sort of the backside of all my school notes, not paying attention. I found for most of school I could get by, you know, and by get by I mean like, you know, get A's by just listening to the lectures and then, you know, hitting the right bubble on the test. And so I was just not paying attention. I was just making up stuff all the time. And so I would keep writing. I finished something that's probably a novella in middle school, pieces of which actually remain in Sun Eater's world building in like weird little ways, names and things like that, but also in my Sword and Sorcery project in ways I couldn't possibly explain. But nothing's really wasted, right?
For those who don't know, you have a fantasy trilogy you're writing next.
Yes, right? So I also have these Sword and Sorcery short stories that I've been writing.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
A lot of the stuff, sort of the basic premise comes from like the really, really early days. So like these ideas are still conserved. So when I say it depends on how you count, I really started something you'd recognize as Sun Eater when I was like 16. Okay. And I finished The Murdered Son when I was like 22. And that's when Daw Books picked it up. And I did the traditional thing. I got an agent, you know, querying. I think we talked about this in the last video we did together. And then it was published about 2 years later. It got pretty extensively revised. Murdered Son became Empire of Silence and so on. But it started really early. And it was just, trying to do things like the things that I liked, which, I don't think I've ever really stopped doing. You just sort of, as Tolkien says, the tale grew in the telling. So...
I have heard that at one point in this story, in your head, Batman was in it.
Yeah, I did say that at the gala, didn't I? Yeah, I probably, so really how I started telling stories is we played make-believe at recess. And when I was in kindergarten, my friends wanted to play Dragon Ball Z, which I was not allowed to watch. And so I did not know what that was. And so I asked them if I could be Batman. And as all five-year-old did, they conferred at length, debating whether or not this was legal. They eventually decided, okay, probably their moms told them to stop bullying me. We were friends after that. But because Batman was hanging out with Super Saiyans, which he kind of does anyway, we had to sort of, we built our own lore as kids, right? And by like third grade, everyone was really playing their own original characters. And we had like one kid who was just the villain every week, and we'd defeat him on Friday and he'd be someone else on Monday. He was a, David, you know who you are. And
sounds like you bullied David.
No. He was great. Are you kidding? And they all stopped though, you know, around middle school. They discovered sports and social skills, and I just stayed inside at recess and kept doing this by myself. And
now look where you are.
So to all my teachers who said, why don't you exercise? You were right. Here we are.
You know, Christopher, they're not mutually exclusive.
Correct.
You can and write a book and also
and you should, right?
Hit the gym.
You know,
those are both options.
No, 100%. Yes. I do box a little bit. I've been trying to get back into it, but the whole having kids thing sort of slowed things down for a while.
And that's why you had to write 4 to 8 a.m. for most of Shadows Upon Time.
Yeah, Shadows Upon Time was mostly written between the hours of 4 and 8 a.m. because I have two little girls and they require a lot of minding, and so especially with the my first one, my wife was still working, and so she was kind of my baby, and I just slept less, and that was really more book six. No, it wasn't. Book six was written before she was born. It was book seven. The early parts of book seven.
It's been that long where book seven's both the longest book you've ever written, took you the longest amount of time. It's what, 375,000 words on paper?
It was 425,000 words.
Okay.
Originally. We cut 50,000 words out.
How do you cut 50,000 words?
Well, fortunately, my editor is my good friend Dave Butler, DJ Butler, Reed Witchy Eye. Dave is a genius. I think he's one of the best world builders alive, but he's also just a very good editor. And it was very Dave made it very easy. He went through and was like, you might consider everything that I highlighted could be removed, right? And he would highlight not just like passages or suggest a chapter might be cut, which we actually didn't, I think. I think we cut one chapter. Yeah, we cut one chapter.
Do you know the chapter number?
It was around 18. There was something that just there was a weapons test that got removed. It was kind of redundant, and we just didn't need it. And so we cut that one chapter. With Disquiet Gods, we did the same thing. We cut no chapters. We actually added one, but we managed to remove like 80,000 words from Disquiet Gods. But mostly he was highlighting rambling he was cutting just like paragraphs that were too long or things that I'd already said. I think in a weird way, despite this being the longest book, I think it's probably the leanest. We were really hard on it. Because the length was the book was very long, and the longer books get, the more problems they pose publishers. And so we needed to trim it down a little bit. They were very accommodating with books four. When I turned in the original book four, it was 320,000 words, and they told me to cut it to 200 or split the book into two volumes. So that became Kingdoms of Death, Ashes of Man. This time I turned in 425, and they were like, can you get it under 380, please? And that was a lot easier. That was better. This was not the worst challenge, but it was the longest book. And working on any single project for that long, you know, whether that's writing or, you know, I don't know, you're a builder or something, is kind of psychologically exhausting because you just like want it to be over in some way, right? Like, not that I wasn't enjoying the work on the day, but it's like, man, like how long is this book, right? I started November 11th, so almost exactly 2 years ago now, 2023, and I finished it, I think, in August of this year, finally, like revisions and everything. And that's a long time to work on the same thing.
Let's say, but that leads into a good question of like, how does it feel now that a series that you started when you're roughly 16 and now two kids later it's finally over. How does it feel for Hadrian Marlowe to be a little bit out of your head?
Yeah, well, what I said at the gala, how I've been feeling for the last few months since I finished is rather like I've had, and this is not a very, I don't know, it's not a very happy sounding metaphor. It's not an encouraging bit of marketing copy, but it's the truth, is that I feel like I've had a sick relative for more or less my whole life who everybody's worried about, mostly me. You know, I've been taken care of very intensely all the time, and it's just passed. And there's like a relief, right, in a weird way, but there's also a sense of peace there, you know, because it's over. Because when I'm writing, right, you know, I didn't realize how much bandwidth I was dedicating to thinking about the scene, the book, the series, right, this thing, that thing, all the time, right? I prefer to work up here by myself because I like mutter to myself. Even when I'm like, when I'm writing, I sound out like everything to make sure that the sentence sounds good, that that really is a line of dialogue a human being would say and not, you know, wouldn't. You know, but I also just, I talk to myself. One of the things I realized is that because of the, because I had YouTube on my phone, I wasn't talking to myself anymore. And my, I was getting more writer's block because I wasn't just talking to myself. And so I had to block YouTube. I took it off my phone and like prevented myself from reinstalling it. I've like one of those.
We also support that.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh yeah. Right. No.
Yeah. It, watch YouTube on your computer with full attention so you can see Rich's library actually.
Yeah. That's
it's
the
great
way to do it.
Do that.
Or you know, you just subscribe to us. And then when you're done watching our video, you delete YouTube and you download it every Monday and Friday. That's the ideal that way too. To consume YouTube.
Unless we change our schedule.
Yeah.
Unless we change the schedule, then that's all out the window.
We got to the point where I was watching so much YouTube, I was like, I'm not even playing video games. Like, I want to play video games. So I needed to get off my phone.
It's even it's taking away your other...
Yeah,
free time that you would just
The social media is so insidious because there's so little friction, right? You just open your phone, there it is, and like, oh, I can watch that, I can watch that, I can watch that. Mm-hmm. I do in fact want to know about Assyrian cuisine circa, you know, 2000 BC, please. Yes. You know, and like it's easy to tell yourself that's actually research, right? And that's work, and it is actually, right? But you know, not for the thing you're working on, not today. You just want to know what Ashurbanipal was eating. That's a trap. So yeah, I had to stop doing that. I don't remember how we got here, but now you know. Ancient food YouTube channels. There you go.
It's actually a very niche. That's more niche than Fantasy Booktube.
Yeah, it probably is. Yeah. Like, it's not just tasting history, although that channel is amazing. But but there are other ones. You know, the food is cool, right? Everybody likes food, almost, and history is also cool. You know.
But, Christopher's got a mean gluten-free pasta that you... he's got a really good gluten-free pasta.
I just found one that doesn't
that
fall apart. Austin and I were talking about this. My wife doesn't... tries to avoid gluten. She's not good at it. But so we've tried a few, and Austin was like, they all fall apart. And I was like, I have one.
the one gluten-free pasta.
We're not sponsored, though, so we're not going to say it.
Yeah, no, never.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you, with this book being the 375,000 mark, were you confident that sending this to the publisher, they wouldn't ask you to split it? Were you at the point where you knew you had the liberty to write that much? Or were you nervous that they'd say, hey, cut it down?
No, they told me 380. Yeah, initially they told me, don't worry about it. And then it got really long. Like, when we said, don't worry about it, we thought you were sane. And then they said 380, which was very generous, actually. Because there's a physical limit on how long books can be in sort of, if they're glued spines. There's a limit on sewn too, right? Before the things just start to break. Physics, thread, glue, you know, paper, these things can only go so far. And really, like Dostoevsky and Brandon Sanderson are kind of pushing it, actually, right? You know, if you look at those Sanderson books, like there are no running headers. The page numbers are like shoved way in the corner.
Dumas, but, well, you got your Monte Cristo up there.
Oh, yeah.
Pushes it.
Yeah, yeah. That one's unabridged.
To be fair,
but
those things are meant to be in a...
Yeah.
In several magazines. Yeah, yes. 100%.
Yes. Now, other than the physical limitations, what are your thoughts on doing very long books in general? Do you think it, at least throwing it out there to you, does... The longer the book is, the more it has to justify. Is it a larger responsibility?
I don't know about larger responsibility, because really, like, in a sense, all books are the same size because they're the size of a plot, right? And like, as long as you're writing the book to the fullest extent of what it's supposed to be, right? You know, there's a sense in where like the size of the drama is the same, right? You know, in terms of like, in terms of like action, right? Like you've got like a thing that happens, right? Your arc. I don't know that like a book's arc is necessarily bigger just because it has more words, right? Because really most of literature takes place off the page. It's in the reader's mind, right? And a short book can be just as big to a reader as a long book, actually, right? It's just a question of how you deliver that story to people right on the page. And that's a different question. I have lost the point because I realized I was not being very clear how I was, and I was trying to figure out how to say this. Can you repeat the question?
All right, Hadrian.
Yeah. No, it's very easy when I'm writing because I can look what I said, but I can't time travel.
The basic idea of like, is there a...
Oh,
is there a greater responsibility, or is it... When you're writing a large book, is there a more pressure that, I have to earn this large book?
I have a greater responsibility to the publisher, I think, in this case, because the real issue with longer books is they're more expensive. The reason that there is only, you know, really one wheel of time is because there's only one wheel of time, right? A lot of us, there's this video essay I would like to make one day when I finally fully articulate my thoughts about this. But because a lot of us get into fantasy, right, on the dint of these giant authors who write these giant series, right, especially in epic fantasy, right, Wheel of Time, right, Stormlight, whatever, right, people think that that is the pattern of conduct. They're like, I want to write Stormlight Archive. You have to earn Stormlight Archive, right? When agents and publishers say, debut writers, we want 100,000 to 120,000 words. They really actually mean it, right? And the reason they mean it is financial, right? Bookstores will allocate their inventory space in the store by the inch, right? They have shelves, right? And so if your book is this long, right, they might buy one of them if you're a newbie author, right? Which means that the total print order, total pre-order order for stores goes down because they're ordering fewer. That means they're printing fewer. That means... the distribution for the book is smaller. That means the ad buy is going to be smaller, with exceptions. There are times when they really, really believe in the debut book, right? And they'll push. But like on average, you're not going to be that person. I wasn't, right? When my first editor told me, just make the book as long as you want. We published Ted Williams. That was like not good advice, actually, right? Because this happened. If people remember, for the first few years of Sun Eater's history, it was impossible to get the books in hardcover because they sold out and they weren't going to reprint them because the orders were just too small, had been too small. And they need to print books in batches of thousands. And despite the fact that I was getting eventually like more than a dozen emails a week asking where the hardcovers were, it wasn't enough to convince the publisher for years to print 5,000, right? Because if they ended up with 3,000 sitting in their warehouse being charged rent for keeping them there, that was a problem, right? So there are all these financial reasons to not write longer books and to not write longer series for the same reason. Because the reason that trilogies are popular, besides the fact that we as humans just like the number 3 because it's cool, is because book 2, if you have to read book 1 to read book 2, book 2 is always going to sell between 2/3 and a third, maybe around a half of what book 1 sells. And the drop to book 3 is shorter, right? It decreases, not quite asymptotically, right? But it decreases. And so by the time you get to like book 7, you might be like so close to zero, depending on the popularity of the series, that there's no reason to print a book 8. This is why I lost my publisher for a while, because they were looking at the numbers and they didn't know that book 2 liked me. They hadn't seen the returns on that yet. They weren't keeping an eye on me and they didn't believe me when I said, have you seen like all this? And have you seen the Amazon sales rankings, which I check, anxiously 87 times a day, less so now, right? But they hadn't, because the sales reports for traditional publishing like come in every 6 months, right? And so they said, now we're not gonna do book 6. The math isn't mathing. And so I would urge, people who want to write to take those recommendations seriously. Write shorter books, write shorter series. Like the reason that those are sort of pat, bits of wisdom is because of the sort of hard science of economics, actually, right? And art is art, but publishing is business, and you need to be good at both to an extent to do the job. Unfortunately, you need to understand why these things are the way they are. And part of the trouble there is that publishing doesn't like to talk to readers. And so people always ask, why is it this way? Why can't I get the ebook with the book, right? Like, you should be able to, obviously, right? But there are contractual reasons between vendors and publishers that prevent that from happening. And that's just the way it is. So like some really deep structural stuff would have to change at a legal, like a contractual legal level, right, to get things to be different. And if you don't know that's the answer, it just looks like arbitrary foolishness. And in a sense it is, but you know, that doesn't mean there aren't real impediments or real forces shaping the industry in ways that you just never think about, you know? So write shorter books, especially if you're a newbie author. Earn the longer things.
It's fair to say you earned the right, though, to get that longer page count.
Yeah, I suffered for it, you know. It was not a straight or easy road getting to book 7, but it is done. Holy cow. You
were showing us a little bit yesterday, your outlining process
for the book.
Do you want to touch on that for people who don't know? How do you get such a big novel onto the page before you actually start writing the book?
Yeah, so a book is like too big for you to really conceptualize, right? I mean, there's some people who like wing it. I did wing Empire of Silence, and I think it kind of shows it. I think Empire of Silence meanders more than the other books. The thing about becoming a professional writer is if you have a contract for 3 books, you turn in the first one, you had an infinite amount of time to work on that first book because you hadn't sold it yet. Book 2, in most cases, they want like a year later, maybe 2 years later. And if you don't have a process that's going to arrive at a finished book in that amount of time, unless that first one sells millions of copies, you have a problem because the publisher will be annoyed with you. They're going to be annoyed with you even if you do sell millions of copies because they want to sell millions more of the next thing. But, you know, it's tough. And I needed a process that was going to get to book 2 as quickly as possible. And I really needed it to be better than book 1. And here I want to touch briefly on my friend David Drake, who passed away a couple of years ago now. Was it last year? And Dave, when I worked at Bain Books, we sort of set our schedule to Dave's because Dave was so regular in delivering novels. We knew like to within a week, right, every year when we were going to get something. He was just so so timely, so precise. He had such a system on lock. And I found some of his old outlines sitting in the office, and I looked at them. And I didn't really like study his process or how he was building the outline at all. I wasn't interested in that. I just looked at them, and he wrote like 100,000-word novels pretty regularly. The books were also like always the same size. Like he was just a very like consistent craftsman, right? And just a wonderful man, just very interesting, just interesting character. And I admired him very much. And just looking at these things, the outlines were like 40,000 words long for a 100,000-word book. He was very thorough, right? And the reason he did that was that like no one's going to see the outline, right? When I wrote a 10-page comic for Marvel, I realized like almost none of what I was writing was my responsibility, really, right? That was on the artist to make it look good. And my artist was Steve McNiven, so I was safe. So I just had to worry about the dialogue, and I had to make sure that the action made sense because he was going to make all of my rambling about appearances disappear. And in a sense, the outline's the same way. There's no pressure to perform, right? You're just getting the ideas out. And so I write like for Shadows, my outline was like 80,000 words long, maybe, which is longer than Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets.
Book.
Yeah. But there's no pressure to get any of it right, right? Which makes it very easy to write because we talk about writer's block, right? You can have writer's block all day, go on Facebook, get mad at someone's opinion about a movie, and then write 3,000 words. Your writing is never blocked. It's fine, all right? It's your thinking that's the problem. And the outline lets you do that in a way where there's no pressure, right? It's a low-resolution draft, right? I try to write as thoroughly as possible. And the thing I always get hung up on is action. It's not character. I think I understand people. I think we all probably think that, but I think I do okay. It's what's happening and why and what do I need to keep track of to make the action continue to make sense, right? And so I outline plot. I worry. And if there's like a note about character, I'll make it like a sub point and I'll just sort of ramble. But I always have the chapter and then the scene. And it's usually one scene a chapter, right? If there's more than one, it's for like very idiosyncratic specific reasons, but it's usually 1-to-1, maybe 1-to-2. And then I'll say what happens in the scene. And that might be like a paragraph. Maybe it's like a third of a page or something. And then as I'm writing that, if I get an idea, like a world building note or something, I'll put that in a subheader. And if those ideas give me ideas, I put those in further subheaders. But there's not really a like system where it's like things at this level are scenes, except at that level. Beyond that level, whatever is under the scene level is just kind of idea, and the ideas that branch off of those ideas. And I just keep doing that until I've exhausted my thinking about the scene. Just whatever idea I've got, and some of it doesn't get used at all, right? Or only ends up informing like one clause of one sentence. But because I've thought about it, right, when I actually arrive at writing the scene, I have my brain power dedicated to not figuring out what the scene is, but how to make the scene good. Because in writing, really all we have as writers is writing, right? Maybe you have some illustrations, right? If you're, you know, you got one of those cool pulp magazines from the other 20s, right? You know, you got Conan fighting the snake. That does a lot of heavy lifting, right? That's what gets people to buy the book. But you have words, right? We, you know, filmmakers have us at a disadvantage because they have the score and they have the cast and they have the script and they have lighting and they have the camera work, right? I just have one channel, like writing prose is mono. It's not stereo. And so you have to make that good, right? You have to focus on the words. You have to focus on how you're using, the rhythm of sentences, right? The poetry of it actually to, evince feelings. This is why I have a rhetoric degree, right? I found a way to use it. So if I get plot handled, if I get world building, you know, at least enough that it's standing, right? For the scene, then I can worry about making everything work. In the moment, I can have fun writing instead of stressing about what I'm going to write about. And so, so that's why I outline. And I can, having done that, I save so much time. It took me 3 months to outline Godstain House. But
What about for Shadows Upon Time?
Oh boy, it was probably 4 or 5 months.
4 or 5, and then the writing took you another year on top of that.
Yeah, thereabouts. So, yeah, book 7 was very long. And maybe knock a couple months off about those figures. Maybe Godstain House is 2 months and then it might be closer to 4 with Shadows. I'm not sure. I also, with Shadows, I had to stop and re-outline a couple times because I would get to a problem, realize my outline was insufficient in some way, or that I needed to like kind of divert a little bit and then get back to the sort of main thrust of the action. I would have to sit down and sort of re-outline from chapter 50 or something. Right. And then go from there to the end. And when you do that, I do less outlining, you know, but like I need to get to where I can think my way out of these problems. And part of the problem with Shadows is I did that like 3 times. Mm. I would get somewhere and realize I'd not thought deeply enough about the problem and then have to try again.
And you always knew from page 1 of Sun Eater, the ending of the series. So do you kind of outline in a similar way of the themes of the series where you know the ending and then the journey? You have a little bit more free will in the middle there.
Yeah.
What are you going to change? I'll ask you here. What do you think changes the most when you're outlining stuff to when it goes to the book? Is that first third, middle, or the last third? Where
it's the middle.
Where it gets the most change.
The middle. Yeah. Middles are, I like beginning any project, whether it's a short story. The first day is always hard because you have to like, you really have to get in. Mood is not something I outline. Tone is not something I outline, right? It's something you find in the writing. And that's sort of, You set that with the first page. You need to, especially the first line, you need to sort of give people a sense very quickly of what it is they're in for. And I might write the first line of even a short story like 20 times trying to find the right one. Or you've written 3 paragraphs and realize the first line is in the 3rd paragraph, right? And, you know, but you don't find that out for a couple hours. So the first day I never expect to get very far. But I love the first like 10 chapters of a project because there's a kind of excitement and momentum to it. And the ending is great because there's also, you know, people talk about sort of the books picking up in the final act, right? Like I feel that too. Right. You know, and I suspect people talk about the Sander Lynch's, right? I'm sure he feels it too.
We coined Rocchio Slide, by the way.
Yes,
I don't know if any of the fandom said that, but that was us.
We take full credit. Yes. No one else has ever thought of that before.
Nope.
It's all us.
Nope.
But like, I think everybody maybe feels that because you have a clear sight of the goal and it's like when you're running, which of course I'm an expert at, and you see the finish line and you hurry up a little bit. You know, I was at a park yesterday with my daughter and it was getting dark and she was getting scared and we were walking to the trail back and I saw the parking lots and I distinctly remember walking faster, right? And it's like, there you go. Like, that's where we're going. It was getting dark. I was a little lost. I mean, it was a straight road.
Did
but
you
I was
mention
like,
that Richard was following you guys and that's what made it scarier? Yes,
that was the
Richard
root
was
of the
just,
fear.
He was just
and your daughter said, bald! Started running.
It was actually, Richard was the light.
Yeah.
Yeah. But okay, Christopher, we want to get to some of the fun stuff now. So is it spoiler warning time?
Yeah, we got to ask the spoiler questions. That's what we're here for. We got to get there. So
let's do it. Okay, this is going to be a spoiler warning for the full series. Okay, you got The Craft. You got How Did He Make the Book? And I got to say, if you notice, I don't know how far away the camera is, but my eyes being a little droopy, yours too. We were up until 3-4 a.m. still read, because we did not time appropriately. Of we're like, oh, we could finish this. We wanted to read it close to the gala event so that it was fresh for us. Of okay, we're ready. We just finished Shadows Upon Time. Now we could talk about it with Rocchio.
There's also the problem we were sent the e-arc.
Yes.
My brain looks at an e-arc and go, oh, I don't know how long that is.
Right.
Words count? Don't check that.
Hence our questions about the length. We went into this going, oh, we could bang this out in a couple days.
So after I started going through, I'm going, that percentage hasn't moved a lot. I've been reading for many hours.
Goodness.
Yeah. Did not realize until the thick of it that this was a... This is a thickums.
So yes, it's 100,000 words longer than the second longest one.
So we are coming fresh off of just finishing this. We haven't filmed our review yet. So just to know where Rich and I are coming from, just finishing it, I loved it. I'm happy I get to say that, because what if I Empire silenced it, where it's like, oh, you're back. You're back to book one.
Well, I said my fear on Friday. I was like, I don't want Empire of Silence Austin back. Yeah.
Like, what do you do? How'd you revert?
5 seconds of the first video. I'm like, I can't watch this. I'm going to be sad. It's like, these guys, they can't come to my house. No.
But yes, that the ending of the book, you wanted to start with the ending. I said before recording, you said you want to talk about that scene on our 2 hours of sleep. Let's go.
I got to ask. It's a confusing question. I don't know if you'd be willing to talk about it, but the message that Hadrian receives at the end, the little telegraph.
Full spoilers, by the way. Spoilers.
I'm doing full. Yes. Come on.
Okay.
Yes. But the telegraph he receives at the very end of the story, where this message that has sent like before time began and has now been received.
Yes.
I don't understand it. We were told the 7 words, and Hadrian says, I think I understand. It says the first 2 words is Hadrian, and like, where are you?
Where were you?
Where were you?
Yeah,
I think
please
it's
give
actually,
it to us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't it?
I can't tell you.
I need people to feel it.
Oh
yeah, sorry, I'm gonna go David Lynch on you.
Wait, where were you when you laid the foundations of Earth, right? Yeah, that's it's from book 6. Yeah. it's from Job, right?
It's from Job.
Yes, but it's that. Yes,
I,
that
was. I wanted to know
he has heard it before.
Yes,
I wanted to know the significance to Hadrian, especially of it. Of like he now, because of that, he knew where he was going.
Well, that was the chapter 40 reveal in Disquiet Gods. Like that was right. That I think it was in chapter 40.
It was in chapter 40.
It was where were you when you? Which, by the way, shout out Salty. You put that in when you signed his book.
He asked me to.
Yeah. Oh, he asked for that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I wasn't supposed to do.
I didn't need Christopher. I just got you. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Austin's carrying the team. Yeah.
What else would you like to ask?
Yeah.
Austin. Can we just film our book review?
Yeah.
So let's give the star rating.
Yeah. I'll head out.
We have to ask you this, because at the gala you said this. You initially had was another additional 2 or 3 chapters.
Yeah, thereabouts. I think it's three.
About 3 chapters that you were going to write, but you said no, this is the place to end the story, which was chapter 91.
91. Right? Yeah.
And I don't know how you could have added, because that did seem like the perfect ending. So what did you have in mind going on after that?
There's some stuff he talks about, particularly when he's in the cell after Lynn leaves, where he sort of talks about this sort of what's happened between the end of the book and him starting to write it, that I was going to make a lot clearer.
Got it.
And if I had done that, it would have said too much and it ruined everything, I think. And it would also have taken, I don't know how much longer, because it would have... Chapter 40 of Disquiet Gods took 3 months to write, and I realized in the spirit of the quiet, I would shut up, and so did.
Yes.
After nearly 400,000 words,
finally,
of course.
Yes. Yeah, well, you know, Hadrian gets a self-own in on that note in the last couple of paragraphs. You know, he's used too much ink. He's going to stop too. So.
Can we mention who we talked about, who we talked with, who helped you with Chapter 40 at all?
Yeah, we
met Father Gabriel, friend of yours, who helped you with Chapter 40, like getting that done. And we were chatting with him, and his mind was blown. That was one of his, where he both helped with the theology of it.
Yeah.
But also on top of that, that chapter is so important to the series. And Disquiet Gods, we gushed about a bunch.
Oh, yeah. It is the chapter that defines the whole point of the series, of the first chapter of Empire of Silence, of you as an audience asked the question.
You know the ending, yep.
Okay, we got the ending of the whole series from the very first chapter, why do you continue to read? And that question continues on until book six.
Well, there's this sense, right? So like I always get leery when we start saying theology, right? Because people's brains shut down.
Oh, shoot. Sorry about that. Our battery just went out, so we had to put a new battery in the camera. So we don't know exactly where we left off, but we were talking about the chapter 40 from Disquiet Gods.
Yeah.
So
we have one more battery. So we got another.
This is the last one.
Yeah. Nope, we got one more.
All right.
It can die again.
All right. So we can all talk about it.
See, just like Adrian, we got three deaths. Yeah. So the camera there you go.
Yeah, because it's three to ramble two. So.
Do you remember what you were talking about right before camera cut off?
Well, we were talking about Father Gabriel, right? Yes. Who is one of my beta readers. I have a sort of a motley crew among whom are counted one Dominican friar.
Yes,
and he was at the gala, which is great. I hadn't seen him in a long time, and he was saying my beta readers, mostly their job is to reassure me the book is not bad. I just want them to read it and say, yeah, this is still great. But occasionally I have like specific subject matter questions, and so. Obviously, just for my own sanity, really, I just want to make sure that like the philosophy is sort of square, the stuff undergirding the series, just because I want to make sure I'm not saying something that's dumber than I think it is. Right. And so he was involved with a lot, just getting stuff sort of square. You had a question about it in particular,
I don't know if this got cut off as well when we were talking about. You had additional chapters after chapter 91, and then you ended it there. I think, did we get through all of that before it went out?
Yeah, more or less. There was more. I realized less was more.
Yes. How the book? So we haven't talked about the book with each other either. We haven't haven't had our review. But
let's do it.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what did you think, Rich?
Oh no, I loved it.
Yeah,
I am currently sitting there between. It is tied. I don't know if it's my favorite book or my second favorite book of the series.
I'm the same, yeah. It's between six and seven for
It's me. Between yeah. six and seven. The only thing that gives me pause is like where book six feels like from beginning to end this its own book that I love. With book seven, it's rather than its own book, it feels like the ending of a series.
So
judging it from that where it is the plot lines that it is fulfilling are not plot lines from that book in particular.
Exhibit A is you did something different in book seven you never did in any prior book with the beginning where you went, and as people were telling the story of Virgosos, we got character point of views and quotes, right? Where they were telling their story from how many different characters?
It's like seven or eight.
What was that decision? Why did you make that choice?
Spite. I get very annoyed in reading reviews or seeing errant comments where people say, I don't really like this series because he can't do X, right? You can't kill the main character. You can't kill him twice. You can't kill him three times. You can't do other point of view characters. Like that's an easy one. All right. It's very easy to put other point of views into a first person narrative. You just have someone tell a story about someone else, right? It's fine. Right.
So that was 10% of your book was spite.
But spite. That's, yes.
The holidays are coming up fast and it's time to shop, but actually have some fun doing it.
Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else.
On uncommongoods.com, they provide art, games, books, DIY kits, home accents, and all sorts of accessories. What makes them unique is that about half of their assortment is handmade by independent artists and artisans.
Uncommon Goods has something for everyone,
for moms, dads, teens, from book lovers to history buffs to anyone who hit their quarter life crisis and started running marathons.
Excuse me. Okay, well, that's my better half, Nicole. She's one of those marathon runners, and I got her a gift from the site. I ordered this custom medal holder for all the races she completes, where there's also a place to put her personal records on there. I'd never seen custom built case like this before, and so I got her the gift, and I'm gonna surprise her with it.
Yeah. Hey, every time you purchase something from Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Also, every purchase you make, Uncommon Goods gives $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice.
So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off of your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/2toramble. That's uncommongoods.com/2toramble for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
I love 10% of your book. Like, that's
I said I'm Bilbo Baggins. I think 10% spite is about right. You know,
I don't know. I think it goes a little bit more of like someone asked me, why did you spoil the end of the series in the very first chapter
because
of the
people
first
say
book.
You can't do it, right?
There you go.
Yeah, well, why'd you
allow your main character to die multiple times, and like, oh, because you can't do, it sounds like this entire series was just spite. Born of spite.
Yeah, you're right.
Was it back to those bullies you had back in school?
No, and they weren't bullies. They just didn't know if Batman should hang out with Goku, and I mean, fair question. Can he hang? I don't know, but no, but it's always funny. There's always a dumb initial motivator to a lot of my artistic choices. In this case, I just was like annoyed with like some comments, right? But then you know, in the same way, you know, like, you know, we mentioned Lynch a couple times, I think, but like, or maybe that was at lunch.
Yep.
Lynch talks about, you know, catching the big fish, right? And he has these dreams, and then he kind of rationalizes them in the filming process, right? You can have like a feeling, right? And this is kind of what inspiration is. And then the thing that makes you a good craftsman, whether that's, you know, you're carving a statue or writing a book, is that you can justify those like momentary flashes with practice, right? And so like, if I'm annoyed that readers feel this way about something, right, like I really all of Sun Eater is born out of my contempt for spoiler culture, right? I just, nothing makes me angrier than people screaming, bro, spoilers at a thing. I just like, I got yelled at in college at one point, probably by Austin, it seems.
I was just going to say, he's talking about you, Austin. You're talking about
they let the author talk.
No, it's I mentioned that King Arthur dies, right? And I got in trouble in this Doctor Who group for saying this, because they were watching BBC's Merlin, and it's like, bro, if you don't know that King Arthur dies at the hands of Mordred at the Battle of Camelon, like, where were you? It's been 1500 years.
You just spoiled Bernard Cornwell for me.
Like,
ruined.
Possibly. Right?
But we're about to read Excalibur.
But the thing is that people like interacted with stories differently, mm-hmm. right? In the Middle Ages, in antiquity, right? When people sat down to watch Agamemnon, they knew what happened to Agamemnon. They weren't watching to be surprised, right? They were watching for the story. And I wanted people to read the story, right? And so to do that, I had to nail some of the expectations to the floor so that you weren't waiting to see where it was going. Because if you do that, you change the texture of the whole experience, right? If you know that this nice, kind of dopey, full of himself child, right, is going to blow up a solar system, how the heck do we get there? And you're thinking about that the whole time as being nice and dopey in the first book, right? You know, and that changes who he is in every scene all the time, right? That changes the book completely. And so, like, sure, it's born out of like an annoyance with being yelled at by the Doctor Who fan club at NC State. You know, you arrive at like a better reason to do these choices. You sit and think about them, right? I always say all storytelling is just decision making. Mm-hmm. And when you make a decision, it presents questions and your answers to all the next questions, and the quality of the questions you're asking yourself is what makes you a good writer, a good storyteller, right? Writing, we gotta talk about rhetoric, we gotta talk about grammar and stuff. But like, what makes you a good storyteller are those decisions, right? That's world building, that's character structure, right? That's everything. And so you can ask those questions, you can start at any stupid place, right? Including just being annoyed in this case. I think it was like a Facebook comment. I was like, wait a minute, if I'm going to do this first person memoir thing, why don't I just annoy people and do things differently? Besides, like, if you watch stuff, you know, there are too many of us, like, we read so that we can be surprised, and we read, and then we go to read another new thing. And great books are great the third time. They're great the 30th time.
Yep.
And you have to write books that hold up that way. And if you, in a sense, eliminate the plot twist expectation angle somewhat, right, in readers, then they have to read for other reasons. And, or you know, and I wanted people to. I wanted people to sit with the journey, right, and read the actual words on the page and not hope what's on the next page is shocking. So...
Then how much fun did you have with after Hadrian does blow up the sun, we had another 10-ish chapters or delving into uncharted territory. That was your true, hey, we did not talk about any of this beforehand.
Yeah, well, that's the other thing, right, is it's also a sort of false assumption that you actually know the ending just because you know the ending. Because, like, stories aren't just things that happen. It's not the Wikipedia article, right? Like, I read the Wikipedia article for almost every movie I go to before I go to the movie, right? Because if it's going to do something really irritating, I don't want to go, right? but usually, if I read something, you know, in the Cliff Notes libretto version, right, and then it sounds cool, then what I really want to see is execution. I'm more excited, having spoiled myself, to read the story. Now, I'm not expecting that everybody should feel that way. And if you, like, don't want to know anything, Austin's not wrong, right? Just don't yell at me about it, right? Like, if I accidentally say, you know, like, you know, King Arthur dies, right?
Here we go again.
You know, yeah.
You think
that's bad? We talk about Lancelot and Guinevere. Like,
I'm going to be using this video for Austin when he complains with me.
When we're when we say spoiler free about a book, especially a newer, but we can't just go give a midpoint. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I want to reiterate. Like, if people don't want to know anything, absolutely right. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the, like, ending explained articles IGN post before the thing is out is that's just mean, right? Mm-hmm. But. Right. It's also mean to just yell at people because they said something like, well, you know, when King Arthur dies. Right. It's like, okay. You know,
well, yeah. To bring it back to the opening scene of Shadows Upon Time, it being born of spite. I did want to ask a question about it of at least when reading it, it did feel a bit like almost a conclusion and ending to Disquiet Gods. Was this something that you took that was going to be in Disquiet Gods and you had to move it, or was this intentional of this was the right beginning?
Yeah, so full spoilers, Disquiet Gods was already really long, right? And so you have to ask questions like, where's the right spot to end the story? And the right spot to end the story is with getting the Demiurge, right? And that's just, I can't rationalize that. I feel like it's self-evident. Like, that's a good note to end on, right? So when I outlined book six, I knew that was the ending. Like, that's the last scene, right? Now, there's stuff that happens after that, and I knew to get the story rolling, right, I needed there to be the time skip. I needed Hadrian to have moved, right? And then I always do these time gaps, almost always, with the books. The only one that's not, that doesn't have a time gap is 4 to 5, and that was because the books got split, right?
Yeah.
And I do that because the adjustment to the initial context also adds interest to the beginning of the book, right? When you start Empire Strikes Back and they're on Hoth, and, like, Han has sort of settled in, he's decided to stay, what that does is partially automate the question of whether or not Han is, you know, is if he's leaving or not. Right now, Han is perennially leaving, right? But he never really does. And it kind of sidelines that question a little bit, but it also seasons Luke a little bit. And, you know, if you've got a character who needs training, right, like Luke does, like Rey does, then the best thing to do is take a little bit of a gap between things, and then, like, they're just better. And, like, it kind of automates the concern that the character is inexperienced, right? You take that out of the way, which is why it was very foolish that Last Jedi did not do that and picked up immediately.
Not every movie and story needs a training montage.
Right.
You can assume.
You can just put it off screen. And we don't have this problem in the original trilogy because of the gaps. And so I needed that gap because I needed to sort of reset the context, because then you're asking questions about where we are from the beginning, right? And then, because in this case especially, I'm setting up the big reveal about the nature of the Chantry and the fact that you've been lied to the entire series in so many ways, right? That could have been the ending of book six, right? But I need something at the beginning of book seven, right? That's the thing, right? Because that sets up the sort of meta problem in book seven, which is not just the Skelson, it's not just the Watchers, it's us, right? It's everybody, yeah. Right? Yeah. It's the Chantry, it's the Empire, everything. Because the whole time everyone's like, oh, Christopher just likes the Empire so much. It's like, well, they have, like, the coolest stuff, but if, you know, you mean, like, actually, no, of course not. You know, everybody is flawed. And so you know, we needed to get to that too, because Hadrian is surrounded on all sides, including, you know, his own, right? And so we needed to get there because that changes the nature of this final look in a pretty significant way. So that needs to be sort of the first act's revelation. The hook at the beginning of the book is the fact that the Chantry have been using machines the whole time, and that's actually, like, they run everything, and it's really a testament to the Emperor's character that he's managed to fend them off bureaucratically his entire life in order to keep humanity from being managed by, you know, this priest caste. And and so, like, that's a big one. Like, we need that at the beginning. And so it had to go in this weird flashback thing, and that was simultaneously an opportunity to experiment a little bit and do parts of the book from Cassandra's point of view and from Ramathanu's point of view and Anaz's, and from even minor characters like Goshal, right? Otherwise, like, so Goshal dies pretty horrifically and super unfairly, because, like, he didn't do anything wrong. He's just, like, a normal guy. That wouldn't land if we didn't have a little bit of extra time with him.
I did notice you took your time a lot with the normal guys in this. We had a kid, Kit was his name, I believe.
Yes.
You had a lot more focus in this book. It felt very different in that. How would you describe it? Yeah.
The characters had a lot more attention,
yeah.
Especially Cassandra.
Yeah.
Because I know Cassandra, you felt a lot more connected with her this book.
Yeah.
And My assumption on all, most of this is Hadrian's evolution, his big moments were mostly in book six. Like, it was the focus. This is more of his swan song rather than the climactic moment.
Yeah, so I have this line about Aragorn, right? People complain about Aragorn. They complain about Tolkien's characters in general as being very flat and undynamic. And they aren't. They had all of their growth before the story started. Aragorn is just a grown-up. And we want all of our heroes to be teenagers, largely because I think we exist in a culture where there are, I think, frankly, very few grownups. I'm not sure I am one. Right. I don't feel like one most days. I have two children, so I better, like, hurry up and figure it out.
But, if you could see the sword collection behind the camera,
These are decorations for a 14-year-old.
If we were to pan the camera up, there's a sword mark on the ceiling.
On the ceiling, that's true.
Yeah.
Whoops.
He's Rocky. I was going, Hadrian, kapow. He was practicing moves. And yeah.
That is basically true. That is basically what happened. I do mime sword fight choreography, because you will make stupid mistakes, like realizing that you can't move your arm in a certain way unless I find I make these mistakes unless I mime them out. So I usually use the cane. My office used to be downstairs where we finished this one, and there were scuff marks on the ceiling. So you think I would have learned my lesson, but I used the actual sword once because I just hadn't held it in a few months. And I cut the ceiling. So, and I have to repaint the whole thing because ceiling white patches so horribly. And I don't want to do that. Painting ceilings is the worst. Walls, fine.
Yeah.
Ceilings, rather get surgery.
But you practicing, Hadrian. Hadrian, turns out you and Hadrian lied to us a lot throughout this series.
Sure.
And is there anything you could say about all the reveals that we get in the end of Hadrian? How many people is he lying to? He's lying to us, the reader, seems like, as well.
Well, he is lying to you, but he isn't a malicious liar, I think I should say.
Noble.
Hadrian is lying because the story's not over. Mm. The story never is, right? I had this realization. I watched this documentary on YouTube, but it was like a real one. It was like from BBC or something, about Caligula. Mm. And the consensus of a lot of the people on this thing is that he wasn't crazy. The consensus was that he was like a populist autocrat who didn't like the Senate. The problem is that we like to say history is written by the victors, but it's not. It's written by nerds. And all the nerds were in the party that opposed him. And so you go and read all of Caligula's critics, right? They're also Caligula's enemies. And of course, Caligula was also not victorious. He was assassinated, but he was assassinated because he was moving. He planned to move the court to Alexandria, Egypt. It would have left the Senate in Italy, which made a lot of sense. All the money was in Egypt, right? Almost most of the population of the empire was in the East. It was in Egypt, in Anatolia, modern day Turkey. It was in Greece and Holy Land. And so it made sense to be in Alexandria, and Alexandria had been the seat of, the Ptolemaic kingdom. It had the infrastructure, right? It was better suited right? Better suited. All the food was there too. Almost all the food production was in the Nile Delta. And so it made sense to move. And so they were about to lose everything, as they did lose everything when Constantine moved the capital to Constantinople, which for which we do not criticize him at all, actually. It made perfect sense that Constantine did that. Alexandria, and in making Constantinople, he made a new city so that it was sort of safer, right? Byzantium had been there, but like he really built a new city, right? And it was his city with his people, right? He just replaced the old power structure, right? And Diocletian had already moved out of Rome anyway and sort of decentralized the control of the empire with the Tetrarchy, right? Which collapsed pretty quickly into Constantine. But he's not crazy. That's actually, that makes perfect sense, right? All those old guys in Rome were mad about it and they killed him for it. In thinking about that, I realized, oh my God, like everything, probably everything I know is wrong, right? You see this too in science. Gravity doesn't work the way Newton thought it did, right? Everything we know is wrong all the time. And so nothing is settled. Nothing is solved, actually. And like the reality is we probably won't ever really understand history unless we live it, right? And we don't even understand those parts. I don't understand why people in my life do what they do sometimes, right? And so becoming comfortable with that incompleteness, right, is something too that I and that in conclusion is something I want people to sort of feel, because the story is not over, right? And some of the best parts of some of the stories we like is trying to figure out what happens next, right? And I do plan to come back, right? I do want to address some of these events and address them from not Hadrian's perspective, right, which will help sort of get at the story beyond him, right? And also recontextualize what already exists. I have like a list of very specific ways I intend to do this. I don't have a plot yet, which is not largely, but it is one of the reasons why I'm doing Doomsong and not more Sun Eater, is that it's not time. I'm not ready to write another Sun Eater series. I need to do something else. Magic's cool. So like, yeah. You know, magic systems, but magic's cool. You know,
I like Hadrian's pretty magical. He's a bad end.
Yes, but it's not a system. It just it works.
Isn't the whole thing with magic systems is it like it has to have a cost? It has to be clear rules.
Yes. Well,
the cost of Hadrian is the pain behind the eyes. It gets headaches.
Yeah.
The severity of the headache
wasn't even there until my second editor was like, it has to cost. I'm like, it doesn't though. it doesn't actually. It has to make sense. There's a difference.
To be fair, that's what I was having the thought of in book four of, wait, how is... Why is Hadrian not doing it? And I know it's
there's
more
an answer.
I was debating between, is this a psychological thing or is it just Hadrian doesn't have powers? It's the Quiet who does this, and ultimately the Quiet just told him, "Nope, you have to be here, and we're not going to let you leave."
It's a bit of both. Yeah. It's a bit of both. One causes the other, you might say. But there is an answer, right? I don't like most modern magic and fantasy because it's just physics. It's just Newtonian. It's a question of energy input to energy output, and it doesn't mean anything. And so you can spend a lot of time learning, you know, how channel fireball works in a particular setting, but that's useless information to you unless you're going to write fan fiction. Like, you don't learn anything understanding, you know, how much tin you have to eat to channel fireball. It doesn't...
Have you read Mistborn? Was that a slight at Mistborn?
This is a joke. All I know about Mistborn is they eat rocks. Like
they do.
That's
eat
all
rocks,
I know.
Yes,
they do eat rocks.
You know,
it is pretty cool.
No, I haven't read any of Sanderson's stuff. I thought that was a funny joke, and I've said it too many times. It's probably lame now. But I haven't read it.
It takes magic and makes it a system. Yeah. Is the whole point? And do you lose the whimsical or the ethereal nature of magic?
The thing I like about magic, I like when magic operates on the level of the meaning of the story, right? When something happens because it's trying to convey something to you, the reader, and it doesn't mean, because in that sense, it kind of analogizes the supernatural, right? Because it's above the nature of the story, right? Mm-hmm. And so that by conveying something to you, because it's speaking to you on the level of the story, right? That feels more like an act of God or an act of the spirits than, you know, you know, I've created a system about like the colors of cheese that I eat causes me to fly or something. That can also be funny. Like, I it's not that I don't get it. I like the bit in Name of the Wind where he puts out all the fires in the village by dunking the scale into the bucket of water. Like, that's really cool. It makes perfect sense. You understand it. But like the fantasy that all of those magic systems are selling you is that you would be a good wizard, right? And there are no wizards. Right. Mm. And so it seems to me to be a bunch of dead air.
It's the catharsis of being, at least how I understand it, is those magic systems work really well for the reader of, oh, if, you know, author told me A and B, I know in my own head that C could solve the problem.
Right.
And it's very cathartic when you actually get to see that and you could theorize yourself on how to solve these
right.
things.
And then you feel like you would make it in that world, right? Yeah. And I understand why that's appealing. I get it, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that this is sort of an invasive growth from gaming. And that it has more to do with making games functional, because when people say there needs to be a cost to magic, right? Is that not mana points? Right. Yeah. Like I'm being trite about it, but like actually, right. The cost should be right. It should be personal in like the dramatic sense. Right. But that's not just the cost of magic. That's the cost to every decision, right. A character makes. Like, I don't think that's a novel statement. Right. Mm-hmm. Characters should suffer. Maybe magic is free, but you just used it to hurt people and they're sad. Right. Like, maybe that's a better story, actually. Right. Or, you know, another valid story. I don't need to know how much mana it took or how many beeswax candles I have to buy. Which, of course, like, there are elements of systematicity in like actual sort of folk traditions. Right. You know, you walk around the grave with a corpse candle X times. But I'm not against any of that. I think that we've developed a bit of an obsession with the idea of the magic system as like the foundation of fantasy. And I don't think that's it at all.
If there's a cost, you were even saying that the making people feel sad as a cost, which one of the big themes in book 7, we see Hadrian repeat to himself, you'll get it. Yeah, you go. Okay.
Vibing.
But the one
Sorry,
of the big
I got the sniffles.
One of the
magic systems make you teary eyed.
I'm allergic to
Christopher's
them.
Being so mean.
One of the big recurring themes is him asking himself, "Am I a good man?" And so him making others suffer, and obviously the eating the sun and killing a bunch of people. Just a couple of things that were brushed on at the very first. We were talking about history and how you have to unlearn history was one of them. But another big theme in the story was, hey, am I a good person? And that
in
being
the previous
a,
book, the answer, well, in a previous book, it was the fact that you're asking that question.
That was in Demon of White. Gibson said that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is
yeah,
an
yeah.
indicator. Yep. Bad men don't ask themselves that question. Yeah. However, it does rear tell ugly head. The question, of course, rears its ugly head again now, especially because Hadrian is going to, and he's determined to wipe out the sun, kill billions. Why does the message from Gibson not stick, and why is this repeated in the final book?
Because it's not right. You know, we're tempted to listen to mentor figures in fiction, for the obvious reason, but it's not good enough. Hadrian, and your clue for this is that Hadrian already like came to realize the scholiasts were wrong, right? You can't just sacrifice emotion. It's a mistake to, actually. Mm-hmm. Like, if you act like a bean counter, like, you'll make exactly the decision that he makes for the wrong reasons, right? It's not a question of arithmetic. Right and wrong is not math. It's felt. And you can't feel that if you strip out emotion, right, in these calculations. You cannot think like that. And you also realize that most of the scholiasts can't think like that anyway, right? Like, the ones that actually are good at their job are so few and far between, right? And Gibson's not even one of them. Like, he's a deeply emotional man, actually, right? But he's still wrong about this. Like, there aren't, like, you know, Solzhenitsyn said that the line between good and evil runs right here, right? Right down the middle of every heart. And we're all both, right? Good and evil. But ultimately, you know, like, no one's really perfectly good, right? Maybe there's not one guy, but, you know, but like, none of us are perfectly good. We make wrong decisions all the time, and Hadrian does, and that's basically where the answer comes out, and because Hadrian doesn't have a good choice, right? And acting in the world, right? It's not possible to do no harm, right? You can't do it. Like, probably we're wearing clothes that were made in questionable ways by questionable people. The energy that we consume is probably doing some kind of damage, right? It is also achieving the good of warming my house and preventing my infant from dying, right? But like carbon footprint, something, right? You cannot act in a way that causes no harm. You have to make choices. And how you navigate these questions is morality, right? And which I think like is in a sense objective, right? There's a lot of play on certain issues, but I think that, we have to figure out what right is, but I think it exists. And Hadrian is trying, he doesn't 100% get there, but realizing this basic fact that he can't do right, even when he's doing right. Right, is important. He has to do what he's doing. It is the best available option, as I've been saying for years, in his circumstances. But it's still not good.
Is a lesson from it that inaction is worse than maybe an optimal or evil
Dante
action?
Would say so, right? It's a bit of a Howling Dark reference. But yes, I mean, one can err by omission, right? You can do nothing and that's bad. I mean, Paul Atreides has that, part of his vision, right? Where doing nothing does not fix anything. And certainly if Hadrian had done nothing, humanity would be gone, right? The universe would keep turning. Sirianni's wrong about that, but humanity would not make it. And that's no good.
And this is one of your big responses to Dune, in a way, of just looking at leadership from the burden of leadership, in this case, versus Paul Atreides and Hadrian are very different characters.
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah.
They just have the same haircut.
They do have the same haircut.
Some would say the opposite. Yeah,
some would say they are the opposite characters. And yeah, so I'm very excited to talk all the themes and stuff when we have our review. And it helps to get clarifications with the author. Don't kill the author. Well, we'll talk about that in a minute, maybe. But yes.
We're going to do it again.
He's armed. It's wood, though, very early in the game.
But yeah, we don't want to take too much of your time. Just want to say, is there any big scene that was the hardest to write for you? Something that you want to say, like this chapter, because you said in Disquiet Gods, it's well known that that chapter 40 was the hardest, most grueling to do. What was the most difficult part about book 7?
Oh my gosh. It was the Ushara fight, the last one. I had to do it a few times completely. So there's a chapter that doesn't happen. That wasn't in the original plan. And, talking about spite as a creative motivator, when I realized I could do it, I laughed, to quote Mary Poppins, long and loud and clear. It was a very evil laugh because people are going to be very upset and they will be, I think. I had one of my readers message me, I think it was Casey, and Casey said, I finally understand, all those memes about the women waking up mad at their husbands for cheating on them in their dreams. because Cassandra dies at Lorien's hands and because of Edward and again, in awful ways. And Hadrian has to watch it over and over because Ushara is trying to make him kill himself. Mm-hmm. And she fails, but like that wasn't in the original plan. I could not make that stupid fight work because it's too hard to make a person fight one of those things. Mm. And I had this trouble with book 6 and I just couldn't figure out how to do it. And I had to do more of it in this one. I had to do it twice, three times, and four times.
What was the
angle that you took to try and bring, divine beings and how they fight the mortal men? What was the kind of trick you tried to use?
Where they really are fighting is in Hadrian's soul, right? In a sense, right? They're fighting. Well, that's what they're fighting for, right? The way that they kill him is by making him make the wrong choice, right? And so the action, in a sense, like I said, isn't action. It's on the level of meaning, right? They're fighting on the level of what the story is about, his story. Right. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of the key that kind of unlocked how it is you fight with, space demons. Right. And so that was really what made it click finally. Of course, there's some little sword fighting and like the Danu fight and there's some like weird JRPG final boss energy a couple of times in the book. So it's, this is a very high-minded answer, but like, played Final Fantasy a fair bit, a little bit of that. So
Yeah, this is, you have a lot of those big climactic, almost ending of book level stuff like you have in the previous books as well, where you have the Danu, am I saying the planet correctly?
Danu, yeah,
you have
yeah.
the Danu fight with Doriaika, and then you, one of the biggest, I love this reveal in the book where we find out the Eternal City is gone.
Yeah.
And it's been gone for years now, and the Chantry was blocking this, and I think this is you've gotten a big ego already because the weekend of the gala, I mean, you're going to hear everybody say like when we went to Dragon
when someone
Steel,
gets a tattoo it was, of come on, your no, thing
I,
on
I,
their
I,
arm.
I feel like I have to denigrate you, but
the,
I can't
praise,
with this
the praise bounces right off my thick skull
okay,
actually
because
it's the criticism that wounds me.
I knew that
I'm
book
immune
one,
to praise.
I knew the book one review got yeah. okay
yeah, but still think about it, Austin.
The politics.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
But I even remember in like earlier reviews, like book three, some of my favorite parts of that book were Annika, of course, and then Colchist and the reveals there. But then I was like, the politicking with Alexander, I was like, that was my opinion. This one, the politicking,
thanks.
Was like, oh my God, that's what the next level took everything that was built from the series and made me, I wasn't the Alexander I thought was a good character. This made everything make so much sense, contextualized Alexander. And it made the Chantry, it made the Empire, or at least a subsect of the Empire with Alexander, all feel like such major obstacles. And they were all both acting rationally, but also made Hadrian's journey for his soul as well. Every bit of that was awesome.
I also what's very interesting was the direction where from the first book, the Chantry being like the bad guys.
Sure. Yes.
But by book two, as it went on, the Chantry are still bad guys. They're still trying to kill Hadrian. But
you get it.
Yeah.
But the thing is, the Hadrian's going around the world. He is going around the galaxy, learning more things and going, you know what? The Chantry's trying to kill me, but they kind of got a point. And when he looks upon Brethren, he goes, ooh, yeah. Okay.
Not great.
Yeah. I mean, the Chantry got this part right. When he sees the extra Solarians, he goes, there is something wrong with replacing yourself with machine. And so I always saw it made the direction of the Chantry may be antagonist, but they're maybe not his enemy, that there's something he could admire or something he would agree with the Chantry on. And then book seven is like a complete reverse back to book one.
That's where we got. Yeah.
Nope. The Chantry
they still
are
have a point,
actually
right?
evil.
Yeah. They still have a point though. Mm-hmm. I try to have everybody have a point. Sometimes I fail, right? Some people don't have points actually. You know who I mean. But yes, right? Like, you know, you need, there's a lot of like, yes, and right. With the world builder decisions, it's like, that's yes, they are bad, but they also serve right a function, right? Or
well,
like Hadrian agrees, yeah,
it makes complete sense of like how else would the Empire that spans across the galaxy even function?
Sure.
The technological communications, all like the Chantry using, like, why would you throw away these weapons? Why would you throw away this communication?
No one ever does.
Exactly.
Yeah,
you don't put the genie back in the bottle,
right? No one. Yeah, Faramirs are not very common, right? Usually you need Gollum to fall into the volcano to solve your issues, because the ring's not getting thrown away. Genies don't go back into bottles. Yeah, exactly. You know, for years, right, people have been like, this doesn't make any sense. I'm like, yeah, interesting. Yeah, so haha. Haha. Yeah, it's like, you thought I was dumb the whole time, commenter. May still be, it's fine, but not this time.
Yeah. Rishi, he also pulled off the magical feat of me actually liking a vision and dream sequence. That's usually the trope. That's a huge feat.
But you
you
like
the dream sequence?
I love David Lynch. I know.
How can you hate dream sequences?
In books. It doesn't translate.
It's the pictures.
Yes, it doesn't. It's the pictures help me. I'm a picture book kind of guy.
I'll do next time I do one, I'll just illustrate the whole thing.
Yeah, more art for me,
like,
thank you.
20 pages of just stuff. It's like, what was that?
The middle of the book just has, like, this one chapter was just a comic.
It's just pictures. No explanation at all. A very House of Leaves. Yeah.
But yeah, so I'll be gushing on the review, of course. I think the more I'm talking about, man, it might be my favorite. I can't decide. When I can't decide it's between early. Two of them, it's early. I got to think on it. Yeah. I got to think on it a little bit.
We have a 6-hour drive back.
Oh, we're going to be talking about the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, literally right after this we do.
Yeah, literally.
But sorry, guys.
We don't want to take any more of your time. Thank you for having this chat and having us over. Yeah, and inviting us to the gala in the first place. Did I cut off a really good question from you before I was...
I got a lot. It's okay. We can always...
You know what?
We'll be asking.
We'll be over tomorrow. Yeah.
let us know, especially down below, what questions you have about the Sun Eater. And maybe we'll be able to do a round two. We'll ask some more questions about the series at some point. But let us know down below what questions you have. What was your favorite stuff about the series? What didn't make sense to you? What didn't work? I want to hear it all. We'll be reading those comments down below.
And again, we're coming fresh from just finishing this. So all that, I got to talk about it. So the whole ride, I can't wait. Thank you for writing one of my favorite series ever.
Oh, gosh.
I absolutely love it.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
That was my biggest worry of walking into book after book six going, this is one of my top five books of all time.
Yeah.
How, like, Christopher, why'd you do that? Why'd you raise the bar so high for me? Like, that would suck if it was second best. Right, you know what I mean?
Quick glazing.
I'm sorry.
I didn't do that. Yeah.
You already did. I get to do it.
It was that nerve-wracking thing, too. Sorry to make this a long outro.
I felt it, too. I was part of what took so long is I was just freaking nervous about it. Until it was done, you know, like we were saying at the beginning, you know, I stopped the book before the end of the outline because I realized I should. Mm. And I said this to Gala too, but I am not a really inspiration-driven writer. Like, I just follow the outline once I write it. But when I do have an insight like that, right, you know, I usually just do it. And because when I do it, you know, those ideas are the things I feel the most confident about. Like, all the stuff in Demon and White where the Chantry messes with him in the middle of the book wasn't in the outline. It's like, oh no, the Chantry. They need to be in the book. And, that's one of my favorite sections of the series, actually, because I like the politics stuff. I think the book seven stuff is better. I'm with you. But, that was a good start. And for the inspiration to strike on the last page of the last book of the whole thing made me feel good about all of it. And so, by the time I was finished, I was pretty sure the book was good. And I was really to the point where it's like, if people don't like it, they're wrong. I don't care.
That is a good attitude to have. You're still at that pace of whatever series you write next. You're doing this trilogy. You're still writing something you want to read. Is that the advice you would still give to authors?
Yeah, you should only write books that you want to read. You shouldn't write books for the algorithm. You shouldn't write books to impress anybody. Unless you're trying to get married, I guess. but you need to write books for yourself. And my audience is still the 18, 20 year old me, right? These were the books I wanted to find and never quite found, right? You know, a lot has been said about the relationship between my work and the work that inspired me. But the whole point is that growing up a science fiction fan, other writers would turn left when I wanted to turn right, and vice versa, zig when I wanted zag. And I wanted to try and put the sort of pattern of a story that I thought I was reading so many times into one place so that I could actually have that story. And that's this one. That's why, you know, it's a response to Dune. That's why it's Wolf stuff. That's why it's got pieces of this and that and the other thing in it, because I wanted people to try and see how I got here. You know, people are saying, well, isn't that, you know, stealing? But I thought I was citing my sources. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people get that. But science fiction as an art form means a lot to me as a means of storytelling. As you know, people ask all the time, would you write like normal books? And why? Why would I ever write stupid reality, as Homer Simpson calls it, right? In fantasy and science fiction, which are really the same thing, right? You know, you have these larger than life symbolic structures sort of concretely in the story, right? You know, Tolkien talking about Macbeth is like, wouldn't it be better if the trees actually did come to the hill, right? That is better, right? It is better. As such, the science fiction fantasy meant just so much to me, and I wanted to give back, and I wanted to sort of put together the experience I had growing up a fan of this stuff and of the thoughts that I had that got me to where I am and to be, I guess, who I am. Because you want to talk about the death of the author. I'm not dead, The guy who said that is. So, you know, I guess we'll...
What are your thoughts on Death of the Author?
Yeah.
For Rocchio's thoughts on Death of the Author, head on over to patreon.com/tutorample. That's patreon.com/tutorample.